الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر
God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Creator and the Sustainer of the Universe. I greet you with the greetings of all the prophets, from Prophet Adam to Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. Welcome to Islam in Focus. Today is the third program in our series of Muslim beliefs. In today's program, we'll be looking at the Muslim view of magic. I have as my guest on today's program, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Welcome to the program, Brother Jamal.
Assalamu alaikum.
We've just finished two extremely interesting programs in this series. The first, of course, dealing with angels, and the second program dealing with jinn. And I wonder if perhaps before we get into today's topic, dealing with magic, if you could take a few minutes just to review for those people who may not have had a chance to see our program last week, the points that we touched on in this very interesting area of jinn. I think this is an area that's not commonly known to a lot of viewers here in North America. Could you just highlight some of the things we talked about last time?
Perhaps you could do that by referring to the chart that we used last time, in which we indicated that among God's creatures, there are two basic types, seen creatures and unseen creatures, and we said that among the seen creatures we have the humans and others, and we said that among humans, of course, you have the believers and unbelievers. Among the unseen creatures, there is the angels as one category. That was the subject of our first program in this series. And there is also the jinn, J-I-N-N, which is actually an Arabic term that I couldn't find an exact English equivalent. But you can perhaps best understand it by thinking of jinn as unseen creatures, which are different from angels, in a sense that they have free choice like the humans. In other words, they're not created good by definition like angels, but they have the same freedom of choice like humans to be either believers or unbelievers. And we mentioned also that the father of unbelieving jinn, if you will, or Satan, capital S, or Iblis, as the Quran calls it, is the very first Satan. That's the one who tempted Adam and Eve in paradise. And we indicated that Satan, or Iblis, the great Satan, was not of the angels, because angels, by definition, cannot disobey God, according to the Quran. But he was among the jinn who had the freedom of choice to obey and disobey, and he chose to disobey God. And we indicated also that the term devil or Satan, small s, actually refers to the descendants or legion of the devil, the big devil or the father of devils, as well as also the legion of other, his legion of other human beings who are unbelievers, that they both cooperate for evil and corruption. And we indicated last time that as a principle, a believer, a Muslim, should not think in any way that Satan's or devils has any control, have any control over him, or that they have any authority over him or her, and that it is up to us to use the freedom of choice that God has given to us to decide between right and wrong, and to stand in the face of deceptive techniques used by devils or satans.
Okay, thank you very much, brother. Now, moving into today's topic, what about this question of magic? Do Muslims believe in magic? And what about sorcery? Is sorcery the same thing as magic?
I would rather, when you say believe in, I think we have to make one distinction there. When you say, for example, a Muslim believe in God or believe in prophets or in angels, it carries a lot more weight than saying, for example, a Muslim believe in the existence of magic. I prefer magic. In fact, I would prefer to call it a Muslim believe in the existence of something called magic, but not necessarily believe in magic, because it's a different category altogether from something that the Muslim is required to believe in, like God, prophets, and angels. With this observation in mind, I would say there are different meanings of magic, and perhaps when we define our terms, it becomes easier to expose Islamic point of view on this. Usually the word magic, or the equivalent in Arabic, which is called sihr, S-I-H-R, sihr, could have at least three basic meanings. One meaning of magic does not necessarily refer to sorcery. It could simply mean enchantment or attraction or charm. Like you say, he used words that were so effective, they were like magic on him. That it is so eloquent, so beautiful, so truthful, that it has magical influence in a sense of attraction or enchantment. So this could be one meaning. And in that sense, then, there's no problem.
Yeah.
Actually, the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was quoted as saying, "Inna min al-bayani la sihran," that some appropriate truths, which are presented properly, has the effect of magic in a sense of attraction or enchantment. There's nothing wrong with this. Sometimes we talk also about magic in a sense of having some kind of trick or illusion. Well, if that's used for the purpose of entertainment of children or adults for that matter, that's fine. Pulling a rabbit out of a hat and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, if it's done for the purpose of entertainment, it's fine. Actually, there could be some books even that teach you how to play those tricks. There could be nothing wrong basically with it. But this same kind of tricks, when it is used to exploit people or strike terror in their heart or give them the illusion that some human being has some kind of superpowers, then it is wrong and condemned. In fact, we find reference to that in the Quran about the magicians in the time of Prophet Moses, peace be upon him, and during the Pharaoh's time. And that appears particularly in chapter 7, verse 116, in which the Quran says that when the magicians challenged Prophet Moses, peace be upon him, they started making all their magic works to see whether he can match them. And it says, when they threw this kind of magic works, they bewitched the eyes of people and struck terror into them. And they showed a great feast of magic. So the idea was to impress on people or to claim these superpowers. This is something that is condemned. In fact, the Quran explains this type of magic, that it is simply a skill in illusion. For example, referring to the same type of people, the same situation elsewhere in the Quran, that's in chapter 20, verse 66, it says that when these magicians, through their works, their, quoting, their ropes and their rods seemed to him, that is to Moses, on account of their magic, to be in lively motion. So they threw sticks or ropes, mm-hmm. and because of certain tricks they might be using chemicals or whatever, it gives the illusion that these are serpents, going around.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the Quranic explanation of that particular type of illusion, which is basically superstitious, really. However, we find reference in the Quran, however, to a third type of magic, which perhaps would be equivalent to the word sorcery. That is, magic which is used for sinister type of purpose, at times possibly by invoking evil spirits, like we were talking earlier. We said that among the unseen creature, like the jinn, are those who are unbelievers who might cooperate with some unholy people in giving illusions to people or trying to exploit them. Now, there is reference in Quran to this in chapter, for example, 113, where it says that a believer should always seek refuge in God and God's power against, quote unquote, those who breathe or blow in the nuts, which is part of the witchcraft. It doesn't say that they can harm you just out of their own will, but it simply say invoke the name of God and His protection against this kind of evil deeds that they do. In fact, there is reference in the Quran also in chapter 2, in verse 102, which indicates that people who are learning this sometimes learn through various magical formulas how to sow discord between a man and his wife. Now, I know some interpreters interpret that in a variety of ways, not necessarily meaning magic, but could be possibly some evil deeds or prompting to create division among people. But there are all those also who believe that it may be possible that with the use of these evil spirits, they may try to really, or attempt at least, to do harm to other people, or what people usually know as something like black magic, mm-hmm. for example. This is so these are varieties of meaning, what the magic really means.
Well, leaving aside for a moment the question of magic in the sense of enchantment, what does Islam say about the other forms of magic, especially about sorcery, which you just touched upon in terms of your definition of magic? What does Islam say about sorcery?
Well, the position of Islam on this is very clear. In fact, in the same verse that I quoted before, in another part of it, in chapter 2, verse 102, mm-hmm. it says that those buyers of magic have no share in the happiness of the hereafter. It's a very, very strongly condemned type of action. Not only this, we find that the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, has indicated in one hadith or saying that among the seven greatest sins which really destroy the person, at least destroy his welfare in the hereafter, included in the seven is magic. Actually, it comes immediately after associating others with God. In other words, the greatest sin is to associate others' powers mm-hmm. or gods with deity or with God, the one true God. Next to that is as-sihr or magic or sorcery in that particular sense. So the position of Islam is quite clear on that. It's absolutely condemned.
Now, you talked about the use then of sorcery and magic, those who use it to perhaps for wrong purposes. How about learning of magic without necessarily using it? Is this also wrong according to Islam? Is the learning and the acquisition of knowledge about magic?
In fact, we find a reference in the very same verse. It's an interesting one, really. That's chapter 2, verse 102 also. It talks about people who learned magic in the past, that they learned what harmed them, not what profited them. And obviously, when the Quran says about something that when you learn it harms you, then you better keep off. Indeed, you cannot really separate learning magic from using magic, because learning magic, or particularly sorcery, is very tempting for the person to use it. Mm-hmm. And when it's tempting to use, it may also be tempting to use it for evil. We are humans. We might get angry with someone. We might really be envious in a negative sense to someone else. So to cut the evil tree from the roots, Islam also prohibited learning even of magic.
Okay.
In fact, if I may add to this,
yes.
Many people reported to me, for example, some people who might have heard of cases, that many of those people who try to practice sorcery or get into this very slippery road, many of them end up going crazy. Mm-hmm. Because they get some kind of domination by the evil spirits, or even by imagination, whatever happens to them, but lots of them really end up being crazy. It's a very dangerous area to get into. So it's better to keep off.
Okay, let's look at another set of circumstances then. If we forget a minute about using magic and we refrain from learning magic, what about the case if a person just goes to somebody, to a magician or to a sorcerer, to ask that particular person to help to solve a problem?
Is this permissible for Muslims?
It is just as condemned as the position of magic. So let me give you some evidence of this. In one of the sayings of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, it says about certain category who will never enter into paradise. And one of those categories is a person who believes in magic. Because, of course, when you go to a sorcerer, it means that you believe in him. You believe in some powers that he can profit you or harm you.
Yes.
And this is totally against Islamic belief that God alone has the absolute power, that nobody, absolutely, a human or unseen creature, can inflict any harm onto you against the will of God or contrary to God's will. In that sense, then, it's a question of methodology in Islamic jurisprudence, that when something is forbidden and evil, then learning it is evil and believing in it, or even resorting to someone who uses it, is also evil, because there is no distinction there. If something is evil, it should be evil for everybody else. So, in that sense, an ideal society, in the view of Islam, is a society that's free of all this sorcery, witchcraft, or wizardry.
So, well, okay, then if we accept the position that seeking the help of magic or a magician is forbidden, what should a person do when faced with a very serious problem?
Well, I'll suggest four basic points that one should keep in mind. Whenever you face a difficult problem, Islam says that first of all you must have the very firm, unshaken belief that there is nobody absolutely who shares in the divine attributes of God, in his power, in his authority, in his control over this universe. Like I said before, that nothing ever can happen or take place in this universe against his will. There is no competing power with God. He is the sovereign of the universe. So this, of course, includes, like I said, human beings, jinn, diviners, magicians, sorcerers, or any other creatures, because all are creatures. There's only one creator, everybody else, and everything else is a creature of God. The second point that we should keep in mind is that to believe in magic to help you resolve a particular problem has an implicit or carries an implicit hidden assumption that somebody else can't benefit you or harm you, which is a kind of shirk, as we call it in Islamic terminology, which means associating other gods or other powers with God, which is regarded as blasphemy. A third is that Islam provides a more constructive and positive way of dealing with difficult problems. That a person should try to depend upon God. Dependence upon God does not mean fatalistic type of attitude, but it simply means that you do what you can, but you ultimately believe in the final authority of God. You petition him, you invoke his name, you pray to him to guide you and help you in that. But fourthly, like I said, this is not necessarily contradictory with doing your best.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you have a problem, try to use your God-given rationality, God-given mind, which is should be used, not put on the shelf. It may not be enough. You might seek the other mind, seek the help of other human beings, people who are sincere in giving you some advice. But like I said before, when problems really get complex, you could also invoke the name of God and ask for his guidance, because the mind alone and intelligence alone may not necessarily by itself resolve all problems. You might get that extra help. But you've got to do first what you're supposed to do, and then leave the rest to God.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to address another related kind of question, and that is this question of divination. Now, I think you've touched on this just a little bit in the answer you've just given, but I'd like for you to perhaps expand on this a little bit in terms of the position relating to divination, or seeking the help of someone who claims to be able to foretell the future, fortune tellers, that kind of thing. Is that possible?
Well, the term used for unseen in the Quran is called ghaib, something that's absent from us or beyond our knowledge. But you could divide this unseen or unknown things, or things that might fall in the future, or let's say things that relate to unseen in general,
mm-hmm.
into three categories. there's one category of information which only us didn't have access to or don't have access to.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you talk about something that happened during the days of previous prophets or prior to that, something that has not been documented, for example, in history, because there may be other documents or other references, then we can say that we don't know exactly what happened in that particular period of time because we were not there. But there were other humans who were there who knew of it. So this is one type. A second type of unseen are information which are not accessible and were not accessible to any human being. Example, what happened to the earth or on earth before the human being lived on it?
Mm-hmm.
No human being has been there, so people make theories on the basis of whatever facts are available, but still it's not that certain because no human being knows it for sure. And then thirdly, there's also other information which relate more to your question. Information which is impossible for any human being to know without revelation.
Mm-hmm.
This includes things like knowledge about God, what will happen to us after death, life hereafter. These are all information that you don't have just a place whereby you can go and read or study it and say, that's it. It's got to be communicated through revelation. That also includes the knowledge of the future. Again, this is something that it is impossible for any human being to sit down and say in X years why things are going to happen. So the basic rule, according to the Quran, is that the knowledge of the unseen, of all categories, in fact, lies exclusively with God. Let me just quote you one documentation, for example, on this. In the Quran, in chapter 27, verse 65, it says, قُلْ لَا يَعْلَمُ مَنْ فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ الْغَيْبَةِ إِلَّا اللَّهِ. That is, none in the heavens or on earth except Allah, or God, capital G, knows what is hidden, that is, in the future. So this is the basic rule about the unseen. Even the prophets of God themselves, the messengers of God, were instructed not to claim that they have any knowledge by themselves, because this is another issue, by themselves, of the future. For example, in chapter 6, verse 50, it says, say, about Prophet Noah in particular, say, that's to your people, I tell you not that with me are the treasures of God, nor do I know what is hidden, nor do I tell you I am an angel. That's a prophet even who is quoted to say that. The same thing also directed to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in the Quran, the last revelation in chapter 7, verse 188.
Mm-hmm.
Say, telling him to tell people, say, that is, say, O Muhammad, I have no power over any good or harm to myself except as Allah or God wills. If I had knowledge of the unseen, I would have multiplied all good and no evil should have touched me. I am but a warner and bringer of glad tidings to those who have faith. In fact, there was a little story that's narrated in Tirmidhi, which is a collection of the Prophet's saying, in which they say some people came to the Prophet, peace be upon him, and they said, they hid something in their hand and said, right, tell us, you know, what's there? And his answer to this, he says that I am not a diviner, and divination and diviners are all in the hellfire. That is, the message of the Prophet is to guide people not to play all these kind of things. And there are other evidence in the Quran, for example, in chapter 34, in verse 14, there is mention about even the jinn, other than human beings, the spirits, not knowing about the death of Prophet Solomon, peace be upon him. So there are plenty of evidence in the Quran that shows that the basic rule is that the knowledge of the future is the exclusive domain of God, except as he wants.
So then I think we can gather then from your answer that in our previous discussions of prophethood, where we talked about the ability of prophets to be able to foretell things which actually happened at some subsequent time, based on what you've just said, then this is not an exception to the general rule that you've just explained, that, you know, prophets are not fortunate to tell the future, so to speak.
It is not an exception if you're talking about divination, but it could be admissible if you look at it as prophecy. I think the distinction perhaps could clarify this point.
Mm-hmm.
You see, when you talk about divination, we're talking about people who claim that they have certain supernatural power to exploit other people, to commercialize whatever they're doing, and telling people what is going to happen to them. And, you know, they charge all kind of money for this, or at least some do.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes divination also is based on the claim, false claim, of contact with supernatural beings or spirits or devils or whatever. This is definitely wrong. In that sense, there's no exception. Divination is wrong. If it's wrong for everybody, it's wrong for prophets. But when you're talking about prophets, the chosen messengers of God, whatever they have foretold about the future is not really divination, and I'm glad that you raised this issue. What they have really talked about is prophecy. And prophecy means that a prophet is not claiming to know future just by himself.
Right.
He simply claimed that God has revealed certain information to him. This is why you might have noted that in the last part of my answer to the previous question, I said that the basic rule is that the knowledge of the unseen is the exclusive domain of God, unless by his explicit will, that is, by giving such an information to a particular prophet. There's one interesting verse about this in the Quran, chapter 72, verses 26 and 27. It says about God, عَالِمُ الْغَيْبِ فَلَا يُظْهِرُ عَلَىٰ غَيْبِهِ أَحَدًا. That is, he, God, alone knows the unseen, nor does he make anyone acquainted with his mysteries or with the unseen except an apostle or messenger whom he has chosen. In fact, this could be regarded as one explicit thing in which the Quran mentions about specific information conveyed to a prophet. But of course, if a prophet is a true prophet, he would not boast out of that. He would simply humbly admit that this is something that God has blessed him with.
Mm-hmm. We have about 3 minutes left in the program, and there are three other interesting areas for me that I'd like to get into, and I don't know if we'll have time in the time we have remaining to cover them all, but I'd like to move now to this question of astrology and the stars.
Mm-hmm.
How about those people who use the stars as a source of information about the future? Is there anything in the Quran that makes reference to this kind of use of the stars?
You're referring to astrology, horoscopes.
Yes.
And people that perhaps you can include in the same vein, people who talk about reading your palm or something of that sort. Well, I think from a Muslim point of view, most of these things is nothing but superstition and exploitation of people, and at times commercialized type of activities. It sells lots of books, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, tell a whole lot. Sometimes things might happen by way of coincidence. But just let's look at this. You open any paper any day and you read all these things about the horoscope, and you think that it tells you exactly what's going to happen to you because you have been born in that particular month or that particular period of time. But we forget that when you talk about, about 4 billion people who are in the world today, perhaps you'll find a few millions
mm-hmm.
who are born exactly in the same period. How is it that all of those people have the same type of personality and the same kind of events that happened or likely to happen in their lives? It's just incomprehensible. The Quran does mention something about the stars, but not astrology or horoscope. It mentioned something about the stars, for example, in chapter 15, verse 16, that God has created the stars as a sort of beautification of the skies. This is one function, beauty, to observe and awe and remember the bounties and the power of God. In chapter 6, verse 97, the Quran mentions something about the stars in terms of positive benefit also as guidance to people in the darkness. It guides people traveling in the sea or on land. Thirdly, in chapter 25, verse 61, it talks also about God making lanterns or light in the skies. And an interesting verse also in chapter 10, verse 15, it talks also about the sun and the moon, the sun as shining glory and the moon as light, which is quite interesting because the words used in the Quran shows that the sun is a source of light, whereas the moon could be regarded as only light or reflection.
Right. I wish we had time to pursue this further. I wanted to get into the whole question of good and bad omens, good luck and bad luck and so on, but we're getting some frantic signals from our crew that we've exhausted our time for today, so we'll have to conclude our program. I want to thank you for appearing. I want to invite all of the viewers of the program back to our program next week when we'll proceed with our series on Muslim views. Next week we'll be looking at the question of what is the soul? What happens to it after death? And is there an afterlife? Thank you for watching Islam in Focus. Hope you join us next time. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you.
لا إله إلا الله.